This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It may seem like just yesterday that we finished voting in the 2020 election, but if you live in Cincinnati, you've got another big election to concern yourself with this year, too. Yes, it's the race for mayor and, of course, city council as well. The filing deadline was Thursday at 4 o'clock, so now we know the makeup of the field of mayoral candidates. A lot of heavy hitters are in it, but some that we had expected as recently as a few months ago are not on that list. We start the weekly news review with Cincinnati Business Courier columnist and reporter Chris Wetterich. He joins us via Zoom. Chris, thanks for coming back on.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael.
Always a pleasure to have you. You know, we have you on frequently, and sometimes it's with other reporters like Sharon Coolidge from The Inquirer, and back in the old days when Jay Hanselman was still with us, Jay Hanselman from here at WVXU. And we inevitably,
sad.
I know, it still hurts to talk about. We talk about the mayor's race and how inevitably at least P.G. Sittenfeld was going to be in it, and maybe Chris Smitherman as well, current members of City Council, though we should note P.G. Sittenfeld is suspended from council pending federal investigation on bribery charges. They're not in the race. So how different does this field look than, say, what someone like you who pays such close attention to City Hall thought it might look like a year or so ago or 6 months ago or 3 months ago?
You know, when you consider, you know, who's actually in it, it's a lot different than what we expected. But and we'll get to this in a minute. But I wonder how much the overall tenor of the race is going to change. And we can talk about that in a minute. But, the people who the last minute filer yesterday of note was Councilman Wendell Young. He's been on council for three terms now. He had announced earlier that he intended to run, but he had not yet turned in his signature. So that was kind of the one filing yesterday that we had not known about. Vice Mayor Smitherman also announced that he's not going to run. And so did Councilman Sittenfeld. I think with Smitherman, he had been circulating, or someone had been circulating petitions on his behalf late last week. So he was, you know, there was clearly an option for him to get into the race if he wanted to. But he ended up sticking with his decision that he had made actually last year to forego the race.
Yeah, he had originally decided not to run, citing at that time the recent loss of his wife to cancer, and that he wasn't going to mount a race. But with some of the developments at City Hall recently, he was giving it another look, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, when he decided to bow out in 2020, of course, the tragic death of his wife, that was weighing majorly in his mind, and he felt that he needed to focus on his family. And I think that's ultimately kind of what drove the decision, yesterday or in the days before, whenever he actually officially made it to himself. That's just a terrible situation. And, I think he just stuck with what he believed was best for his family there. Councilman Sittenfeld, we were curious what he would do. I mean, it was very hard to imagine that he would run for mayor while under indictment. I don't know how you could run for mayor, how you could visit with voters, and how you could try to campaign and especially raise money while under indictment, because I think there's nothing else that you would probably be asked about if you were out on the campaign trail.
Largely considered by many people to be a front runner to be the next mayor of Cincinnati. I think a lot of people were anticipating a race between P.G. Sittenfeld and another current member of City Council, David Mann, and that's not going to happen following Sittenfeld's arrest. We should note he maintains his innocence. He's fighting these charges, but ultimately decided that he could not fight the legal charges against him while also mounting a mayoral campaign.
Yeah, exactly. And while there were some questions as to whether he would file or not, I mean, no one was really sure. It's hard to imagine doing it. And that's kind of what he cited in his statement yesterday. He basically said, I need to focus on what's best for me and my family. And, of course, staying out of federal prison is probably the best thing for his family at this point. So that makes total sense. But when we step back and look at the race from maybe where it was 6 months or, prior to Sittenfeld's arrest, you had a situation where PG was going to run against David Mann, and he had gathered a lot of support and a lot of campaign money to do so. And now we have a situation where Aftab Purval, a kind of a political heavyweight in this town who has won two elections to county office and did pretty well in his congressional race, given the gerrymandered map that he faced. So, he's in a situation where he is well-known, well-organized. He has a pretty good structure in place already. And he has the ability to raise a lot of campaign money. So I think he comes into the race as the clear favorite. And while there are a lot of other people running against him compared with what Sittenfeld faced, you know, you kind of have a heavyweight. You kind of have a clear favorite at this stage of the race.
Aptap Purival is a Democrat. He is the Hamilton County Clerk of Courts. He's been elected to that office a couple of times, and he was a Democratic nominee for the first congressional district and lost to incumbent Republican Steve Chabot back in 2018. You say he's a political heavyweight. I've seen some criticism out there that, you know, what job does he really want, right? Because he's been elected clerk of courts. He's run for Congress. Now he's running for mayor. You think he's the early favorite here. What gives you that indication, Chris?
Well, because of his potential to raise a lot of money, because of his, I mean, a congressional race makes you very, very well known because of all the television advertising and the campaigning that you have to do. And so, you know, that I think is what makes him the front runner. We've also heard of some polling. Now, we haven't seen the line by line results of it, but the Sensei Business Committee has done a poll, and it has shown him in a one-on-one race with many of the potential candidates and leading them. So that's kind of our educated guess as to where things stand in this race at this point.
Somebody else who has been in local politics for a really long time is David Mann, a current member of City Council. He has been a candidate for this office for some time. And he is another Democrat in the area who has lost a congressional race to Steve Chabot. He previously held that seat as a Democrat for one term before losing his reelection bid to Chabot. He's been in the halls of the city building from dating back to the 1970s through the 80s, and then came back in 2013 and has been there just about since. So what's his constituency, Chris, for David Mann in a race for mayor?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, if you try to chop up the electorate, you've got to think that David Mann's going to try to attract some of the more conservative people, some of the people who are worried about experience at City Hall. I think you're going to see David Mann make that experience argument against someone like Aftab Purival and saying that he has been, you know, remember that not only did he serve in Congress, but he served a long stint on council prior to term limits before back in the 70s, 80s and early 90s. So he has a long record of experience at City Hall that he is going to push out to voters. And he's going to say, look, we have all this corruption and instability at City Hall. I have not been a part of it. And I'm the best person to really get a handle on things, spearhead the reforms, and steer our city in the right direction. I think that's the case that you're going to hear repeatedly from him.
That's an interesting point that you make, because Councilman David Mann is a Democrat, but there's not really a Republican in this race of consequence. So is that, how do you go about cultivating that strategy? I mean, Republicans in Cincinnati are probably used to choosing between Democratic candidates in the mayor's race anyway. What would attract them to David Mann, do you think?
Well, I think that what would attract to him is that he's not Aftab Purival. The Republicans in town really dislike Aftab Purival for some reason. I think the Chabot, when you're in a congressional race, that becomes a very, very partisan thing, and you get a lot of national issues. And Aftab Purival ran as a clear progressive in a 2018 race against Steve Chabot. And so that has kind of, made him persona non grata with Republicans. So they're going to be looking to the extent that they can for a Democrat that maybe, you know, shares their values, which at City Hall, it's like Republicans always want to see less spending. They want to be a fiscally conservative person. David Mann might fit that. I mean, really, they're kind of in a rock and a hard place. While they play a significant role in city elections, they're ultimately going to probably be stuck with a Democrat here. I mean, clearly they are, because there is no Republican in the race.
We're talking with Chris Wetterich, a reporter and columnist with the Cincinnati Business Courier, about the mayor's race that is taking place in Cincinnati in 2021 in the field of candidates that will be running in the primary scheduled for May the 4th. A couple of other council members were exploring runs for city council as well, for mayor as well. Chris Seelbach ultimately decided against it, but Wendell Young did file petitions. Of course, the Board of Elections will have to verify the 500 valid signatures or more that he's turned in. Tell us about Wendell Young and what role he'll play in this and how he builds any type of potentially victorious campaign.
Yeah, I think that and we shouldn't also forget about State Senator Cecil Thomas, also a former.
He's the next
member.
One I'm going to bring up, I promise.
But I think they're related to each other in the sense of, you know, you're going to have a sizable African American vote. We always do in city elections. So, and that's very, very important. John Cranley won the mayor's race in 2013 by having that black vote. So the question is how is that going to be distributed? Are African Americans in this city, are they going to coalesce behind a single candidate, whether it's Aftab Pierval or Cecil Thomas or Wendell Young, both of whom are African American, or are they going to split their votes among those folks? And so the way that that vote is distributed, I think, determines whether David Mann or Cecil Thomas or Wendell Young potentially makes the general election with Aftab Pierval, who I think is clearly the favorite to do so at this point.
Well, that's an interesting point that you raise about possibly dividing the African-American vote in Cincinnati among the black candidates. And State Senator Cecil Thomas, as you noted, did serve on Cincinnati City Council prior to being elected to the Ohio State Senate. He's a Democrat from North Avondale. His signatures have been verified, so he is expected to be on the ballot. Based on what we've just discussed, I mean, you've got those four that you might classify as the top tier candidates. Do you think all these names end up appearing on the ballot in May? Do you anticipate perhaps that some will assess the situation, assess the field, and assess their own standing and possibly withdraw?
It's a good question. I mean, there's always going to be potential deal making. You know, Wendell Young is closely associated with Dwight Tillery, the former mayor. And so there's a perception of Wendell Young as being from that wing of the Democratic Party. Cecil Thomas has a long, long history in Cincinnati politics. He played a major role in the police reforms of the mid-2000s. And he's a guy who could potentially appeal to West Side conservatives because of his history as a police officer and in law enforcement. I don't know that there could be any deal between any of the candidates to get out. I'm sure that some will be, you know, talking about that, but I haven't heard any rumblings that actually will occur.
We should note there are, of course, other candidates who have filed and have their signatures verified to run for mayor. They include some from the business community, like Gavi Begtrup, who is the former CEO of Ekron Systems and WaveTech. He served former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords in Arizona. And we've also seen Rafael Prophet, who is a retired firefighter here in Cincinnati. Herman Najoli, who some voters might remember as an independent candidate in last year's Hamilton County Commission race. He finished third behind the ultimate winner, Democrat Alicia Reese and Republican Andy Black. Adam Kohler is the co-founder of Dot Loop. And then Kelly Prather, another candidate from last year's county commission race in a different race, has run for multiple offices in recent years. Any of those, Chris, expected to break out of the pack and find a way to make a name for themselves?
I've talked to Mr. Begtrup, and I'm really interested in his campaign. He's raised some money. He's got volunteers. He's been going door to door. You know, it's going to be very hard for somebody without a lot of name recognition to make it to the general election in November. The only way that I can see that they would be able to do that is by having a very, very good ground game and raising a respectable amount of money to do digital advertising. And Mr. Begtrup seems committed to doing the door-to-door work there. So I'll be interested to see how he does and whether he is able to kind of catch fire. I think he has an interesting message. He's got the outsider, I'm not from City Hall message as well. And so, I think he'll be one to watch.
The primary is, of course, in May. Chris, I imagine that we will have you back on the program throughout the season, if you're willing, of course, to offer some analysis and updates on where the race stands. Chris, always a pleasure to talk to you. I hope you have a great weekend.
All right. Thank you. You too, Michael.
And coming up, no-knock warrants in Cincinnati. It appears that black Cincinnatis are more often the focus, even though the use of these no-knock warrants is decreasing overall. That story just ahead on the Weekly News Review. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And you are listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now with a couple of our own reporters from right here at WVXU. Jolene Almendarez joins us via Zoom. Hi, Jolene.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Michael.
Always glad to have you. And we also have via telephone, Becca Costello. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Michael.
Great to have you as well. Jolene, you did a deep dive on no-knock warrants. This is a phrase that I think a lot of people may have encountered for the first time when they learned about the death of Breonna Taylor in Louisville and the circumstances that led up to her shooting death at the hands of police. You found, apparently, that Black people in Cincinnati are more often the focus of such no-knock warrants, even though that practice of trying to use a no-knock warrant is waning. Tell us what you found.
Right. So I put in a records request to get some information. And the first thing that we have is the addresses where all the no-knock warrants in the city have happened for the past 15 years. So I plotted those on a map. And don't get me wrong, there are outliers. There have been no-knock warrants throughout the city. But you can see very clearly that they have been concentrated in historically Black neighborhoods like Avondale and parts of OTR. And then I asked for arrest reports for those no-knock warrants. And I did not get 15 years of arrest reports. Those are still coming. They were not able to get me that by press time. But I got a little less than 5 years worth of data, and it's a little spotty. I think there's still some missing. But what I did find is of those, that Black men are much more likely to have a no-knock warrant issued, to be arrested during a no-knock warrant than any other race. And the numbers are really, really shocking. And then after Black men, it's Black women. And then after Black women, it's white women. And I think in the data I have, there's only one or two white men who are actually arrested during a no-knock warrant. And this is not unusual. Nationally, Black people are more likely to be the focus of no-knock warrants because they are kind of left over, a remnant of the war on drugs, which we know now disproportionately impacted Black people.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask about, Jolene, is what charges tended to emerge when you were looking into this? What led to officers obtaining a no-knock warrant? What were the allegations?
Right. So I that was another data point that I pulled, and almost exclusively they involved drugs. Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes it's, oh, this person had a handgun and they were not permitted to have a handgun. And then about five drug charges. Now, these aren't just your daily user, somebody with a small amount. So, you know, these are people who it seems like they may have been dealing drugs or in a house where drugs are being dealt. But they are mostly being used for drug crimes. Now, the new reforms that the Cincinnati City Council may be considering in the next few weeks would mean that no-knock warrants could still be used. So there would be an all-out ban, but elected officials, some elected officials anyway, are saying they want to see them used in life-threatening situations like a hostage situation, terrorist attack, active shooter. And that's just looking at the data, that's just really not how they have been used in the city.
Was there anything that surprised you when you started to dig in locally?
No, well, I was a little surprised at the disparity. I mean, you hear these numbers nationally, right? But it's sort of hard to get a grasp on what that means, where you live and where you work. And so to pull the numbers and see like, oh, wow, this is how like great the disparity is, you hate to see it in your community. You hate to see that one race is being arrested just drastically more than another. when data shows that white people and Black people, they don't use drugs in a different rate. They don't sell drugs at a different rate. Black people are just more likely to be arrested.
You can see the maps that Jolene referenced and that were created for this story at WVXU.org, along with this fascinating full report in its entirety. We also have with us Becca Costello, who is on the phone with us. And Becca has been spending a lot of time at City Hall in her new job with us here at WVXU. And I think you're learning quickly, Becca, that affordable housing is commonly discussed among members of council. And there were some more developments in that respect this week. One member of council appearing to back away a bit from this plan that would mandate affordable housing units as part of new development projects. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, you're right. Affordable housing is kind of the topic being discussed at City Hall right now. It's come up in from multiple council members with ideas on how to address this housing crisis. So this in particular from council member Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, the idea was to, if there's a new development of a certain size, it would only be larger developments, was going to be built in the city, and it includes any housing at all. The idea would be to make sure that at least some percentage of that was affordable, and that usually is defined as you're not paying more than 30% of your income for housing, and that those would be affordable in order to get benefits from the city, like tax abatements, things like that. Now, even then, it was just an idea. It wasn't defined. They hadn't defined all the terms or what percentages or things like that. But Kearney said this week, basically, she got some feedback from, she says, and also from developers. Seems like that's probably more likely, or the most common feedback that she got, saying that that would be really difficult for some developers to meet those standards. So they're kind of backing away from this idea of a mandate. But again, this is all just sort of an idea stage anyway. So what they're doing now is basically just going to do a report that says, what are the ways that we can incentivize affordable housing in the city so that when developers come here, they're actually making housing that, you know, low and middle income Cincinnatians can afford.
And one of those reports, I don't know if this is the same thing that you're referencing there, but apparently there's this new subcommittee that convened this week, according to your reporting. And then the Budget and Finance Committee at Cincinnati City Council is expected to discuss what is being called a balanced development scorecard. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's, I think, three of, you know, maybe a dozen different efforts going on. Like I said, there's a lot of going on with affordable housing. So next week, this balanced development scorecard, it does include affordable housing, but it also includes lots of other things. You know, when they say balanced development, that includes things like making sure developers are hiring local workers, that they're prioritizing minority-owned businesses in some of the, you know, commercial space that ends up in those finished projects. That they're using sustainable methods, that kind of thing. So that does include housing, but that's kind of more of a much broader look at how to make sure developments are benefiting the city in exchange for getting some of those tax abatements. And then, yeah, that subcommittee seems like kind of a big deal. They don't do subcommittees very often at City Hall. It's kind of rare, but they've decided that this is a big enough issue that they want to make that a focus. First meeting of that was this week, and they'll be meeting every week, I believe, and basically just going in depth on this issue. So far, they're calling it a fact-finding committee. So they're just bringing in speakers from city administration, from the port, all kinds of different stakeholders, kind of present all the information, and then hopefully they come out on the other side with kind of a more concrete plan of what to do.
Becca Costello is doing a great job as our new reporter at Cincinnati City Hall, and you can read her reporting as well at WVXU.org. Before I let you all run to get on with your work and then your weekends, Jolene, we would not be a proper Cincinnati media outlet if we didn't talk about salt in the midst of this massive winter experience we've had in recent days. Tell us about the bottleneck at Cargill, where I guess the city gets its salt.
Right. So this winter has been a little bit different. At the beginning of February, there's a polar vortex that kind of went over the whole country. And because of that, everyone in the area put in salt orders from Cargill, the people who are served by Cargill anyway. And the big rush of orders just meant that the trucks, it takes longer to receive the orders. And so Cargill wants to say they are not out of salt. Somewhere, somehow, that kind of rumor got started, but they have plenty of salt. There's just a little bit of a delay in getting it to suppliers. Now, in Hamilton County and a lot of other places, they have salt on hand to last, but some places are running a little lower than others. But the salt is coming, and the weather forecast looks really good. It's really sunny where I am, and I think for the next few days, we're not going to have any major snow, so that kind of gives cargo a chance to catch up and get these orders out there.
Let's hope they don't need that salt after some slick driving in recent days. And always read Becca Costello's reporting and Jolene Almendarez's reporting at WVXU.org. You can also see them on Twitter. You can find their Twitter handles at the website as well. Occasionally, you'll see Jolene's dog on Twitter, which she loves to show off. Jolene, Becca, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having us.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The CEO of Kroger talks about the grocery giant's record year and what it learned during this pandemic that may be lasting at the company on the other side of COVID. Steve Watkins, a reporter at the Cincinnati Business Courier, talked to me earlier this morning. Here's our pre-recorded interview. Steve Watkins is a reporter at the Cincinnati Business Courier. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad to see your coverage of Kroger. Kroger's obviously played an even more significant role in our lives, not just here for local people, but all across the country. It's such a large grocery giant. And goodness knows, we've all been going to the grocery a lot more than perhaps we used to because we're eating so much at home. And that was something that you learned, I think, when talking to Rodney McMullen, the CEO of Kroger, for this profile you did, that he learned that people are spending more time cooking. Was that a surprise to him?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was able to talk to Rodney one-on-one, which does not come up very often. He's a great guy, but doesn't talk to the media a whole lot. And so I was able to talk to him one-on-one for about a half an hour or a little more a couple of weeks ago for a cover story. And yeah, I asked him what surprised him. And he said one of the things was not that people cooked from home and ate at home as the pandemic raged on, but how much they enjoyed it and acted and talked as though they will continue to do that even after the pandemic is over and things return to whatever semblance of normalcy we finally have. He gave me a great anecdote. He talked about a CEO. He didn't name the person, but he said, this is a guy who, if he says something, and if his company does something major, it shows up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So in other words, a CEO of a pretty big company, not in this local market, but in one of Kroger's markets. And the CEO told Rodney McMullen that his family was cooking dinner almost every night, and they were cooking with their kids who are in their 20s. They all enjoyed it. It was kind of a family connection type of activity. And, you know, the CEO said he learned how to cook and that he expects them to continue to do this. And Rodney McMullen and others at Kroger have heard this over and over throughout the pandemic. And people are kind of relearning what it's like to do that and how enjoyable it can be. And that bodes really well for Kroger, even coming out of the pandemic.
Well, Steve, you cover Kroger and all the local big businesses really well. You're always very good at explaining the business side of just the brands that we know and utilize so frequently. And I'm wondering, I mean, just guessing, it must have been as bad as the pandemic has been. And I'm sure even Rodney McMullen would agree this is a terrible period of time. Has it been a windfall for Kroger?
It has. In a way, not surprising. I mean, as you said, you know, anybody that's gone to a grocery store, which is pretty much all of us through the pandemic, you see people with their carts almost overflowing, a lot more people there. I mean, if you think of all the money that people spent at restaurants before the pandemic and the vast majority of that or a significant majority of that has been transferred to eating at home, you need more groceries. So yeah, Kroger's same store sales, which typically rise at the beginning of last year, people thought, analysts thought it was going to rise about 2.5%. Probably they rose 15% through the first three quarters of the year. So, I mean, just an astounding difference. And that's because all of this shopping that was not expected to be done. I talked to an expert for a story back in the summer, and he told me that the amount of meals eaten in restaurants versus eating at home was about 50-50 before the pandemic. after the pandemic, it was something like about 90% of meals nationally were eaten at home versus in a restaurant. So that's a huge difference. And it all goes to Kroger and other supermarkets for the most part.
We're talking with Steve Watkins, a reporter at the Business Courier, who recently profiled the Kroger CEO after getting a rare chance to talk to him for 30 minutes one-on-one. What has Kroger and the CEO of Kroger, Roddy McMullen, learned about their business model during this pandemic that they think will propel them for even further growth on the other side of this thing?
Yeah, one of the things Roddy McMullen talked about quite a bit for Kroger is the push for pickup and delivery. Kroger has invested literally billions of dollars the last several years in a variety of initiatives focused on making pickup and delivery more efficient, easier, faster for customers. He told me that the pandemic probably accelerated 5 years worth of customer transition to that form of shopping into a span of 5 weeks. That's how much people, they didn't want to go out. I mean, a lot of people are still in the stores, but a lot of people, way more than usual, are ordering from home and either going to the store to pick it up or having it delivered at home. And that kind of forced Kroger to make sure all their systems were set up. He said he was very gratified to see their systems could handle that load, but it also forced them to really make a lot of adjustments on the fly that will last for a long time. And he expects a lot of customers to continue to do that, to shop that way.
So let's talk a little bit about the way the employees are benefiting or not benefiting from this windfall that Kroger has experienced during this pandemic when we've turned to groceries more. In Seattle, there was an ordinance adopted by city officials there that mandates that grocery stores provide an extra $4 per hour in hazard pay to frontline workers. And that's something that I think a lot of us recognize, not necessarily the ordinance, but the fact that these have become frontline workers. We've all needed the grocery store during the pandemic. And so we're constantly going in there and possibly exposing them to COVID-19. Instead of agreeing to that $4 per hour in hazard pay to frontline workers at the grocery store, Kroger's decided to close two stores. What was their reasoning for that?
Well, Kroger said that those two stores were underperforming to begin with, and the extra $4 per hour that they were going to be mandated to pay by the Seattle City Council ordinance was going to make it financially not feasible for them to keep operating them. So Kroger has said they will close those two stores in April. They have to give 60 days notice. They did the exact same thing at two stores in Long Beach, California a week earlier. And that was also two stores that Kroger said were underperforming. And it should be noted, Kroger has a lot of other stores in each of those cities. In Seattle, it has 13 other stores that are just within Seattle's city limits that would fall under this hazard pay requirement that Kroger is keeping open. And Long Beach, it had, I don't remember the number, but I think the two was about 1/4. I guess they had about 8 to 10 total there. So they are keeping some of their stores open, you know, the majority of them, but they are definitely taking these steps. Now, you know, Kroger says the stores are not performing well. The main union representing the employees thinks it's terrible, of course, that Kroger is closing these stores. And I think people see this as kind of a playing hardball way to try to get cities to not mandate this extra pay. And, you know, there is probably a bit of a combination there. I'm sure those stores are the underperforming ones, and Kroger grocery stores operate under tight margins anyway. And so Kroger no doubt sees this as just squeezing those margins more.
And just for clarification, we should note that the grocery names out there in Seattle and in Long Beach aren't Kroger as far as the brand name goes. It's QFC in Seattle. And then the two stores you referenced in Long Beach, one is Ralph's. I think we've all maybe heard of Ralph's if we've not been to one. And the other one is called Food for Less. So we should note that earlier in the pandemic, last spring, last summer, when this thing really took hold of our everyday lives, Kroger was doing hazard pay for its employees, but decided to end that in the summer.
Yeah, that's right. Kroger started that really shortly after the pandemic began, within a few weeks. I think it was late March last year when they started paying hazard pay. And yeah, they ended it around the middle of June. And, you know, there's a lot of dynamics that go into those kind of decisions. It's, I'm sure, a bit of a balancing act between making sure employees feel valued and watching your bottom line and paying, you know, getting shareholder return that helps your stock price go up. So there are a lot of different factors that go in there. Kroger, unlike some grocery stores, has a huge percentage of its employees are represented by unions. And that plays into it, too. They have agreements with their unions, and so they have to factor that in as well.
We're talking with Steve Watkins, a reporter at The Business Courier. You can always read his reporting at The Business Courier. I don't think I can give the full link on the air, not because I don't want to, but it's like bizjournals.com/Cincinnati, or just Google Cincinnati Business Courier like I do, and you can pull up all of his great coverage there. More news from big companies here in Cincinnati. Scripps, the former CEO, is stepping down as the board chairman, and the company has named a woman successor. We're talking about Rich Baney. Tell us more.
Yeah, it's interesting. Rich Baney is a name pretty well known in Cincinnati. He used to be editor of the Cincinnati Post, for people who remember that paper that was around until about 15 years ago. And Rich was a business reporter before that. So he came up in the newspaper business, joined Scripps in the late 80s, I think, in terms of their corporate office when the company was doing an initial public stock offering, and rose up to become CEO of the company,
and a local kid, nonetheless, right? He's from our area and went to NKU.
Yeah, good point. Yes, exactly. A local guy as well. So definitely a local guy who made good. He was the CEO through 2017 and had been chairman for the last 8 years, remained chairman even after he retired as CEO. But now he's going on to other interests and opportunities, as Scripps CEO Adam Simpson put it. And so Scripps is replacing Rich, whose retirement takes place in a couple of months, with Kim Williams. She's a current board member, and she will become chair of the board when Rich steps down May 3rd. And that makes just two Cincinnati public companies that are based here that have women as chairpersons of their board.
It's interesting that not only are they moving in a different direction from Rich Baney as he steps down and moves on to other things, Ms. Williams, who will take over, she doesn't really have a media background, it looks like, though she has been with Scripps since 2008.
Right. Yeah, she's been on the board since 2008, yeah. And so clearly, as you point out, she has some expertise there, but not in the sense of working full time in that business. She's an investment person. She worked for years for an investment management firm, Wellington, which a lot of people might know, in Boston. And so she comes at it more from the investment side. And but she's been involved with Scripps. She was the lead independent director the last few years, and has been a director for a dozen years. So, yeah, very, very experienced person that knows the company well and no doubt will provide good leadership there.
So Rich Baney is leaving Scripps as a whole bunch of money apparently is coming in. Just before the announcement of Rich Baney's departure as chairman of the board, E.W. Scripps Company announced that it was selling its podcast services company for $230 million. What can you tell us about this deal?
Yeah, it's part of a bigger move that Scripps has been making in the last probably 6 months, I guess. They sold a podcast company called Stitcher that a lot of people might be familiar with, that where you can go to get your podcasts. Scripps owned that, and they sold it last fall for $265 million. Then just this past week, Scripps announced a deal they've agreed to sell a company called Triton Digital that provides technology and services for the podcast industry. And so Scripps is selling those two just as they recently bought National TV Network, ION Networks, and created a national TV networks business from ION and some of the network Scripps already owns, things like Bounce and Laugh and Court TV that are referred to often as running on digital subchannels, which means if you go through your over-the-air antenna to channel 9.2 or 9.3, let's say, you will be able to get those kind of channels. And some cable systems pick them up too. But Scripps is definitely focusing on their TV business now, as opposed to the digital audio and digital media business.
Yeah, I want you to reiterate that. So what does it tell us about Scripps' view of the broadcast future? Because, I mean, all we hear about is podcast being a big part of the future of media. What do we know about Scripps and what it thinks about where the future lies?
Yeah, it's very interesting. You're right that podcasts are talked about a lot, and Scripps seems to be veering away from that. Scripps has, it's interesting because this previews a story I have coming up this next week about a little more detail about their national TV networks business. But that's where they see a lot of potential. And on the face of it, at first, you might think some of these digital sub-channels might seem a little lower profile than, you know, ESPN or things like that. But more and more people are cutting the cord to cable and satellite. And what they're doing is they're watching Netflix or Amazon or what have you, Hulu. And then they're watching other channels through their over-the-air antenna.
Oh, typically. Wow. That's a great point. So like people are coming back to the old broadcast and the digital antenna with all those digital sub-channels because, you know, they don't need the cable packages anymore.
That's right. Yeah. It's funny because it is kind of coming full circle to sense the way people used to watch years ago, except with a digital antenna, you can, instead of getting four or five local channels, you can get maybe 30, you know, MeTV is on there. And a lot of these channels that have throwback nostalgia shows. And Scripps talked about some of the demographics that they can hit for advertisers. And if you're trying to advertise and people only have Netflix and over-the-air and digital sub-channels are the only channels where the advertisers can reach those viewers.
Oh, it's so fascinating. Love the business. Love the media business so much. And always enjoy talking to Steve Watkins, a reporter at the Cincinnati Business Courier. Steve, I hope you'll come back on again soon.
Absolutely. Love to do it, Michael. Thanks.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I am Michael Monks. We finish up the weekly news review now with Inquirer reporter Julia Fair. Hi, Julia.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing well. So I was on vacation last week, drove up to Michigan to spend some time in my beloved Traverse City, the cherry capital of the world. And you see all these billboards advertising marijuana dispensaries, and a lot of stores want you to come in and buy marijuana because you have that option in Michigan. A Northern Kentucky lawmaker would like to see that option available in the Commonwealth. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so this bill came from Northern Kentucky's representative, Rachel Roberts, a Democrat from Newport. Under her bill, you could buy, grow, and smoke weed at home. This kind of bill has been introduced in the past. It used to come from an Eastern Kentucky Democrat, but he decided not to run for re-election this past year. So Roberts introduced the bill. We had a glimpse of what the Kentucky General Assembly might have thought about this kind of bill last year when the House passed medical marijuana. They passed it 65-30, but then that bill did stall in the Senate when the focus pivoted to COVID-19. So now we have a new bill for the General Assembly to consider.
So at this point, we don't know what the chances are of this particular piece of legislation moving forward. She's a Democrat. I read recently that Democrats in either the State House or the State Senate in Frankfurt have had a hard time even getting a bill heard by their committees.
Yeah, you know, the former lawmaker that used to introduce this kind of bill told the Courier Journal last year that he thought recreational marijuana bills didn't really have a chance of passing because of the makeup of the legislature. There is a supermajority of Republicans in the chamber. So, that's what he said about it.
But Rachel Roberts, the Democrat from Newport, says this would bring in some pretty significant revenue. Can you tell us a little bit about the numbers that she's suggesting?
Yes, she is suggesting that we could see as much as $100 million annually in new tax revenue, and she wants to use that to fund addiction treatment, boost educational and economic opportunities for minority groups, and Roberts' bill includes expunging marijuana-related misdemeanors as well.
And it's generally popular legislation, according to public polling, but we'll have to see what the lawmakers in Frankfort have to say about it. She was, strategic in noting that Illinois has it, because while we don't think about that up here in our part of Kentucky too much, Kentucky does border Illinois. And so you hear a lot of lawmakers when they're pushing for one thing or another to say, well, it's in this neighboring state. Was that the point there to say that, look, Illinois, our neighbor, has this. This is the amount of money they're bringing in. We could be bringing this in.
Yeah, she even pointed out how much money Illinois has been able to bring in since they passed this bill. She said that they've been able to bring in $150 million in tax revenue since sales began. It was smart of her to point that out, because we do neighbor Illinois.
We've got about a minute left. I'm so sorry, Julia. We went a little long in some of our earlier interviews. We will definitely have you back soon. It's always great to have you on to talk about your terrific reporting. You had a really fascinating story for subscribers to The Inquirer this week about a man who was found guilty in Kenton County on drug charges, even though he wasn't present for the trial. Give us your pitch for that, and we'll send people to the website to check that out.
Yeah, this was a very, very unique court of appeals case. So what happened in 2019, a man named Ferris Whittaker had a trial date in Kenton County. His trial date had been delayed and delayed and delayed by the state's request. And when the trial finally was about to happen, he asked for a delay to get a private attorney. And the judge denied his request for an additional delay. And they took a break before the trial started. He told his attorney he was going to the bathroom. We now know that he left the courthouse and the trial. So he left before the trial could really start. And so the very interesting thing in that the Court of Appeals case points out, it says that the court erred because they denied him a delay and because they held the trial without him. In Kentucky, you can hold a trial without the person there, but the rules are kind of across the board. So,
what ended up happening was, something that even prosecutors had warned the judge about was like, look, if you do this, it could be reversed. And it was. You can read this reporting at Cincinnati.com. I suggest you just search for Inquirer and Julia Fair. That's how I find all of her articles. Julia, thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Michael. You too.
And all of you listening, thank you. Hope you have a great weekend too. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again on Monday.